The curfew is in force. No one may be on the streets. Not much later, the widow appeared, holding a lighted lamp.
The man is here. It's time.
I got up, making sure I took Bear's sack as well as his hat. I also took some of the pennies we'd earned and placed them in a pocket. Lastly, I touched around my neck to make certain my leather purse was there. I didn't want to leave my sole possession, the cross of lead, behind.
"Widow," I said, "I should pay for our lodging."
"Don't be foolish. You'll need whatever you have." She led me down the steps. In the dimness of the empty tavern room, a man stood. He was rather small, with one shoulder higher than the other. His garb, jacket, leggings and boots, was dark. He had a scabrous face, with a dirty cloth wrapped around his neck. His mouth was a narrow slit.
"God be with you,"
I said to him.
"And you?"
he said, avoiding my eyes. Widow Daventry led us to the back door. Before she reached it, she blew out the lantern. Only then did she open the door.
"The moon is full," she whispered. "Be careful. God keep you well."
"The Lord's blessings on you for your help," I returned. Impulsively, she reached out and embraced me tightly, then with a sigh, pushed me away. I stepped into the alley. The man came close behind and shut the door behind us.
"Follow me,"
he said. Without a backward look, he moved away. One foot dragged, so that as he walked, he made a little scraping sound upon the ground. I glanced up to the clear sky with its bright, full moon. Ill omen or good, it occurred to me that I might never see the sun again. Chapter 53. The man who guided me didn't speak as we moved along narrow alleys and lanes. Never once did we set foot on the main street. But once, when we heard the watch approaching, he slipped into an alcove. Breathlessly, we waited until they passed. It was then I said, "I need you to take me to the White Stag Tavern."
"I was told to bring you to the walls," he said.
"Show the place to me, and I'll trouble you no more. And I'll pay you," I said, holding out some pennies. He put out his hand, which in the moonlight showed me he had but three fingers. I dropped the coins. For a moment he seemed to weigh the money.
"It's not far,"
he said, and limped away. After passing through a warren of muddy lanes, we came to the head of the dark alley.
"There,"
the man said, pointing. No light came from any building.
"Where?"
I asked.
"That building."
He gestured to the head of the alley and a narrow structure 2 stories high. I looked at it again, but when I turned back to thank the man, he'd already gone. All I could hear of him was the foot scraping in the dark. I studied the house he'd pointed out. It was the moon that allowed me to make out a sign hanging over the door, which bore an image of a white stag, ghost-like in the faint light. Not only did the building seem on the verge of collapse, it appeared completely deserted. I approached the building and rapped softly upon the stout door. There was no response. Reluctant to leave, I put my ear to the door and listened. I heard a sound within. Emboldened, I knocked again. The door creaked open. I saw no one, but a voice spoke.
"Who is it?"
"I'm Bear's apprentice," I whispered. "He's been taken."
The door shut. I put my ear to the door again. I was sure I heard voices. Perhaps I thought they were discussing what to do. The door reopened a bit.
"What's your name?"
I was asked.
"Crispin."
"Come,"
someone said, even as the door swung open wide enough for me to slip within. I looked around. A small candle provided little light amidst the shadows. The room was not unlike the Green Man's, but smaller, with fewer tables and benches. I could make out 5 men. Their faces were indistinct, partly hidden with cowls, making it clear they did not wish to be recognised. Still, I had a vague sense that at least some of them were those who had gathered in the shoemaker's house earlier in the day.
"What brings you here?"
I was asked. I was sure it was John Ball who spoke. "Bear has been taken," I said.
"By whom?"
"The soldiers, the ones who came to your meeting."
"Do you know where he is?"
"He was brought to the Furnival's palace."
"Are you sure?"
"I saw him dragged in."
"God have mercy on his soul," someone else said. "They'll torture him," said another. "They'll make him give our names."
"He doesn't know them."
"He won't inform on you," I said. "I'm sure he won't. He's too strong for that. He'd rather die."
"Braver and stronger men than Bear succumb to pain," said one of the men.
"And he's grown weak," the man I thought was John Ball said. "When we met a year ago, he was ready to join us in our brotherhood. Since then, he's altered his mind."
I said, "He says things are not ready."
"How would a juggler know about such matters?" someone asked.
"The man's a spy," John Ball said. "It's his business to know."
To hear the revelation was to know that it was true. The only part of my surprise was that I'd not thought it out myself.
Then John Ball said to me, "Why did you come here?"
"I need to help Bear."
"You can't," said another. "The palace is too well guarded. Besides, they'll have put him in the dungeons."
"Boy," said John Ball, "Bear told me you're Lord Furnival's bastard son. You were most likely the reason our meeting was discovered. Didn't Bear turn away from our brotherhood? How can we be certain of your loyalties? If you had any sense, you would be gone by now."
"It was I who warned you before," I said, "and it was Bear who helped you escape." There was some uneasy shifting about by the men.
"He's lost his way," John Ball said angrily. "We can't endanger ourselves any further."
There were some low, if indistinct, murmurs of assent. I said, "Can someone at least guide me to the square?"
"What do you think you can do?"
"I can't abandon Bear," I said.
"If it's true who you are, they probably took him as bait," said someone. "For you, you're doing exactly what they want."
"I have to try,"
one of the men came forward. "I'll bring you close."
Chapter 54. We reached the square not long after the church bells rang for matins. As soon as we arrived, the man who had guided me disappeared without a word. I looked over the square. The bright moon revealed a field of empty tables and stalls, deserted of its trader swarms. All lay in uneasy silence, putting me in mind of the abandoned village where I had first met Bear. But here, at one end of the square, stood the palace of the Furnivals. It was huge and dark, save for 2 windows on the second level. There some dim light glimmered. Opposite, at the other side of the square, the great church rose up in all its majesty, its stained-glass windows glowing faintly like the embers of a smouldering fire. As I stood and listened, I heard the sound of chanting coming from the church. Priests were at their early prayers. Their blended voices rolled across the square like a rising, falling wind.
Media vita in morte sumus, quemque rimus adiutorem, Nisi te Domine, qui pro peccatis nostris juste ira certis. Sancte Deus.
I made the sign of the cross over my heart, imploring St. Giles to guide and help me, as he had done before. Then I turned to the palace where Bear was being held. Even as I wondered if he was alive, I spied some movement by the central doors at the lower level. Shielding myself behind some deserted stalls and tables, I made my way closer to the palace. When I peeked out, I saw two guards standing by the main doors. One of the men was leaning back. His arms were folded over his chest, his head bent down. He gave the impression of being asleep. The other guard was pacing restlessly. I crept closer and studied the building. It was quite clear that there would be no getting past the main door guards. How then could I possibly find a way inside? Then I recalled seeing John Aycliffe on the balcony. Perhaps the second level was not so well guarded. The problem was to get there. I moved along the square so I could examine the far side of the palace building. There, other buildings crowded in, and in the moonlight, what I discovered was that between the palace and the next building, there existed only a slight separation. It was hardly more than a crevice, not big enough for a man to squeeze into. But I was still a boy. After waiting until the restless guard moved as far away as he was likely to go, I darted forward and squeezed into the breach I'd found. It was so narrow, I went in sideways. It was too dark to see much, but I could feel around. The palace walls were jagged stone. The wall opposite was made of some rough clay or plaster. I put down Bear's sack. If I returned, I could retrieve it. If I didn't return, it wouldn't matter. Barely able to turn about, I was like a kernel of wheat between two stones. I pressed my hands against the opposing walls. Using my fingertips to grasp small edges and bumps, I began to move slowly up. When high enough off the ground, I lifted my legs and pushed my feet against the walls so as to gain even more purchase. Straining every bit of the way, I could climb the walls like a spider. Exactly how long it took me to reach the balcony, I don't know. It was higher than the roof of the Stromford Church. Even when I reached the level of the balcony, I was not where I needed to be. The balcony jutted out beyond the building's front wall, whereas I was lodged against the side wall. Pushing my back hard against the palace stone, while my feet pressed against the clay wall, I managed to turn about. Now I was able to wedge myself securely in place, even as I freed my hands. Just beneath the balcony, a stone carving of a lion, its jagged mouth agape, protruded. By stretching one arm to the utmost, I was able to reach the beast's lower jaw. Grasping it firmly, I released the pressure of my body from the walls. I swung out, holding to the lion's mouth with one hand, legs dangling high above the ground and the guards below. With my other hand, I stretched up and clutched the balcony itself. Now I was clinging to the balcony with one hand. I moved the other hand up so that now I dangled with two hands. Even as I swung my feet in to gain some purchase, I hauled myself up, pulling and pulling again, until I had finally hoisted myself over the balcony railing. To my great relief, no one was there. As far as I could tell, the guards below hadn't seen me. Legs shaking from my effort, I stood on the balcony and gathered my breath. Not daring to waste any time, I hurriedly crept inside through an open balcony door. In so doing, I entered a dim and narrow hall. I neither heard nor saw anything to cause alarm. Only at the farthest end was there some feeble light. I looked about. The area into which I'd come was nothing more than a shallow entryway. I edged forward, pausing to notice doors on either side of the little hall. I set my ear to one of them. When I heard nothing, I pushed it in. In the faint moonlight that came through a high, small window, I saw only flags on wooden poles. I turned to the other door, listened, then pushed it open too. Along one wall was a rack of glaives. Another wall bore broadswords. A third held some daggers. I took up one of the daggers, then withdrew, shutting the door behind me. I now moved toward the end of the entry hall, leaned forward to peer in, and gasped. Chapter 55. Illuminated by light cast from a few all but guttered candles in wall sconces, was a room of vast size. It was far bigger than any room I'd ever seen before, large enough to contain more than 100 souls. All of Stromford could have crowded in. The wooden ceiling was decorated with carved interlocking flowers and vines. Walls bore panel after panel, finely wrought, upon which painted images of saints had been set. At the very far end, just opposite where I stood, was a gigantic fireplace, faced with stone and painted tiles. The dull remnants of a fire burned. Close to this hearth, on one side of the room, was what appeared to be the stairway. Before the hearth stood a massive long table with benches and chairs. The table was littered with the heaped remains of what must have been a great feast. Bones, breads, bottles and bowls lay scattered everywhere, as if voracious giants had gathered to dine. There were mazers and trenchers, knives and napkins, goblets, things I hardly knew, and more than I could count. In the dimness I was able to make out a number of doors set in the walls. One of these doors was open. From the room beyond, a little flickering light emerged. I went to it, and moving cautiously, peeked in. I had come upon something very much like a church, but it was still a room. At first glance, the room seemed to contain nothing but gold, gold that burned with a richness my eyes could barely absorb. These golden surfaces were encrusted with countless jewels, blues, purples and reds, jewels which in the flickering candlelight seemed to pulse with a life of their own. All in all, it was more wealth than I ever could have imagined existed on this earth. At its far end was an altar upon which stood a cross of gleaming gold. Before the cross were some lighted candles that brought illumination to the room. To one side of these candles were jewelled boxes, probably containing saintly relics. Spellbound by such magnificence, I stepped farther inside. It was then I saw that the walls and ceiling were covered with images of holy souls. Their deep, dark eyes gazed down on me with such penetrating grief and wisdom, I didn't doubt they peered into my very heart. Then I realized that on the altar a single image had been placed. It had been set to the other side of the candles, opposite the relic boxes. Here, within a jewel-studded frame, our glorious lady in her flowing robes of blue was revealed. Kneeling on the ground before her was a knight in full armour, hands clasped in prayer, his face uplifted toward the Virgin. To my utter amazement, I recognized the face of the knight. It was my own, the very one I'd looked upon in the stream when Bear had made me cut my hair and wash my face. But now, as sure as I knew anything, I realized I was looking upon the image of my father. Feeling anger and curiosity, I drew closer. The kneeling man appeared so devout, so adoring of Our Lady. Yet I knew him otherwise, a lofty lord without kindness or caring for my mother. As for me, I doubted if he had had any thought at all. Just to see him in his exalted state made me know with finality that I was not him. No, not any part. I was myself, what I had become. Thus I sank to my knees, and putting aside the dagger, prayed that God on his throne, with my mother by his side, would judge Lord Furnival for what he truly was. I was completely absorbed, when a voice behind me said, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" I sprang to my feet and turned about. It was John Aycliffe. Chapter 56. Aycliffe's black-bearded face, hard, sharp eyes and frowning lips were frighteningly familiar. So was the sword at his side. The more I gazed on him, the more my panic rose and my eyes turned toward the floor. "You," he said into the silence, "Astor's son." Though it was a struggle to lift my eyes, I did so. His gaze showed such disdain, I could feel my wrath rise within. Here was the man who had been so cruel to my mother, who had treated me with such contempt and wished me dead, who had murdered Father Quinnell, who had abducted Bear. "The wolf's head," he said. "How dare such a filthy peasant as you even presume to put your foot within this place?" He turned toward the entryway. "If you're intending to call the guards," I said, "tell them Lord Furnival's son has come." He halted and turned back to me. His swarthy face had become pale. "What did you say?" "I am Crispin," I said, working to keep my gaze steady on his face. "Lord Furnival's son?" I saw him glance over my shoulder at the image of Lord Furnival, comparing me to him. "You're nothing of the kind," he said, and once again turned to go. "You know what I've said is true," I said, hoping he wouldn't hear the quaver in my voice. "You've always known." Again he paused. "You're not even human," was his reply. "I've proof," I insisted. "You can't prove what isn't so." In haste, I took out my cross of lead from my leather pouch. "It's written here," I said, holding it up. "It was my mother's, given to me when she died. She wrote the words on it."
"Words? What words?"
"It reads, Crispin, son of Furnival." For a moment he was still. Then he said,
"Anyone can write words."
"Not anyone," I said with growing anger. "It was my mother, and I believe them, as do others. And people will need only look upon me to see who I am. And when I say I am the grandson of Lord Douglas..."
"Give that cross to me,"
he cried, holding out his hand. "No," I said, "it belongs to me." Furious, he stepped forward and lifted a fist as though to strike me. In response, I held up my hand, using the cross that rested in my palm as a shield. He hesitated. "I know what happened," I said. "Lord Furnival brought my mother to Stromford. He left her there with me, making you our keeper and granting us only a living death. When Richard Dubray came to Stromford with news that my father had returned to England and was mortally ill, you were charged with killing me. It's you who fears me. You fear I'll become your lord." He made no response, but his eyes told me that I was right. "It was you who killed Father Quinnell," I went on, "to keep him from telling me who I was. It was you who said I was a thief and proclaimed me a wolf's head so that any man might kill me."
"Your mother was nothing but a servant," Aycliffe said. "She was too low to reach so high. She forgot her place. It didn't serve her well. There's an order to things which God himself has put in place. It can never be changed. How can you expect to stand against it?"
"I came for something else," I said, hardly able to contain my fury.
"Money?"
he said. "Your soldiers took a friend of mine." He said nothing. "He goes by the name of Bear," I continued. "A great red-bearded man."
"What about him?"
"If you'll let the two of us, both him and me, leave Great Wexley, we'll not come back. You'll never see me again."
After a moment, he said, "How can I be sure?"
I lifted my trembling hand. "I'll swear it on this cross."
"You forget," he said, "you're a wolf's head. All I have to do is call the guards. Anyone may kill you. You're nothing." So saying, he turned about and stepped from the room.
I reacted by reaching down, snatching up the dagger, and leaping forward, flinging myself at his back. I took him by such surprise that with a cry he stumbled, tripped, and fell, crashing to the ground. Even as he struggled to reach his sword, I was on him again, knocking him down a second time. I pressed the dagger's point into his neck. "If you call the guards, I'll kill you," I cried, pushing his face to the floor. Panting heavily, he made no response. Summoning all my strength, I drew the blade against his neck. Blood began to flow. "What you wanted for me," I said, "is about to happen to you."
"Will you," he whispered desperately, "swear upon that cross and in the name of God that if I let you and this man go, you'll never come back and make no claim upon the house of Furnival?"
"Willingly."
"And you'll give me that cross?"
"When we have passed through the city gates." Even as I spoke, I worked to keep my hand steady so he never ceased to feel the pressure of the dagger's point. "But you," I said, "must swear first."
"I will,"
he said, as though it was a painful thing to say. I released him. He sat up and touched his neck, looking at the blood that smeared his fingers. "Swear," I said, holding up the cross of lead, but keeping the dagger near. He hesitated. But then he said,
"In the sacred name of Jesus, I, John Aycliffe, swear that I shall allow you, Astor's son, and the man called Bear, to leave this city, insofar as you have sworn never to return, never to claim Lord Furnival to be your father, and to leave the cross with me."
Then I said, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, I, Crispin, do swear that if you let Bear go, he and I will leave Great Wexley and never return. Nor will I ever make claim that Lord Furnival was my father. Furthermore, once out of the city, I'll give you the cross." "Now," I said, "take me to Bear." His reply was to gaze at me with eyes full of hate. But then he got to his feet and began to walk away, saying,
"Follow me."
Chapter 57. Barely believing I had persuaded John Aycliffe to do as I wished, I held the dagger in one hand, even as I clutched the cross of lead in my other. By one or the other, I was determined to succeed. Pausing briefly to take up a candle from one of the wall sconces, the steward proceeded to go down the steps I had noticed in the corner of the great room. To my great relief, he left his sword where it lay on the floor. The steps were very wide, winding down and around to the lower floor. Upon reaching the bottom, we came into a large, enclosed room with many shelves and two large tables. In the dim light, it appeared to be some kind of pantry. There were stacks of flat breads, mazers, bowls and jars in abundance. Aycliffe continued into a hallway. In this place the walls were covered with great tapestries. Here too, for the first time, we came upon others. Who exactly they were, or what service they performed, I couldn't tell. They lay stretched out on the floor, asleep. Having never seen so large and magnificent a dwelling, it was all I could do to keep my eyes on Aycliffe as he passed through what appeared to be yet another pantry. In this place, great quantities of food were stored, so much more than I'd seen at the Green Man. We saw more servants too, but as before, they lay asleep, this time in a corner. The steward went to another corner stairway, this one made of stone. These steps plunged down steeply. Whatever warmth there had been faded quickly. The deeper we went, the colder and damper it became. Sputtering, smoky torches had been set in wall holes every few feet. A few men were sitting on the steps, while others lay sprawled, sleeping. No matter who they were, as soon as the steward appeared, they leapt up and saluted him. Only when we reached the foot of the steps did Aycliffe pause. We'd come to a large, almost round area, constructed of stone, from the floors to the low, vaulted ceilings. Coming quickly to the fore was a man whom I recognised as one of those who had attacked me the night before. There was a puzzled look upon his face when he saw me, but he nevertheless bowed to Aycliffe.
"Sir,"
he started to say. Aycliffe interrupted. "Take me to where the red-bearded man is." The soldier took up a smoky torch and led the way. We were now moving through cellar regions, through one narrow passage after another. The ceilings were soot-blackened. The air was close and foul. Puddles of stagnant water lay underfoot. The walls were streaked with green.
"He's here, sir,"
the soldier said. We had come to a small door set into the wall.
"Unlock it,"
Aycliffe commanded. The man produced a ring of keys, selected a large one, applied it to the lock, and pulled the door open.
"You may enter,"
he said to me. I hesitated, thinking I'd be trapped inside. Aycliffe seemed to understand my thoughts.
"I've made my vow," he said, as though to rebuke me. "You'll not be detained."
I reached for the torch the man held. Before he released it, he looked to the steward. When Aycliffe nodded, I was allowed to take the light. Small as I was, I had to stoop to enter the room. It was small, dark, and stinking within. By the light of the torch, I saw Bear. His great bulk had been stretched upright upon a ladder-like structure, arms bound high over his head, unshod feet bound below, just as tightly. Almost naked, his blood-stained body was striped and welted, as if he'd been whipped. His head hung limp upon his chest, his beard spread like a rumpled napkin.
"Bear?"
I said. He made no response.
"Bear!"
I called again, louder. When he still made no answer, I could only find the breath to say,
"Bear, are you alive?"
When he gave no reply, I drew closer, holding the torch near to him. Only then did I see the slight rise and fall of his chest. Jamming the torch end into a crevice in the stone floor, I used my dagger to cut his bonds free, starting with his feet. By climbing the ladder, I released his hands, first one, then the other. Once free, he slid down to the floor, where he lay in a heap. On my knees by his side, I took up one of his hands. It was cut and very raw.
"Bear,"
I said, "it's me, Crispin."
"Crispin,"
I repeated even louder. Gradually, Bear lifted his head. His face was so bruised, it took a moment for him to open his eyes. Or only one eye, for the other was swollen shut. At first, he merely gazed at me, uncomprehending, repeatedly blinking.
"Crispin?"
His broken lips managed a hoarse whisper.
"I'm here, Bear,"
I said. He continued to gaze at me, as if not sure who I was. Then he said,
"Crispin, I do love you like a son. Did I betray you?"
"No, Bear, you didn't, and now you're to be set free." When he didn't seem to understand, I took up his raw hand and gently pulled at it. "Can you come, Bear? Can you walk? We're going to leave Great Wexley. The steward swore a sacred oath to let us go." He let out a deep sigh of exhaustion. "Bear, you must come with me," I urged as much as begged, pulling at him again.
"Have they caught you too?" he said between parched lips.
"I'm not caught, Bear. We're both leaving, to go free. But you have to come, now. You must move yourself." At last he seemed to understand. Letting forth a great sigh, he summoned enough strength to heave himself up to his hands and knees. Then he began to crawl after me toward the entryway. I left the little room first. Bear followed. When he came out, he managed to only just squeeze through. By the time we emerged, a ring of soldiers had gathered and were looking on in hostile silence. Aycliffe, I saw, had found a sword. It was in his hand. I stood up, but when Bear remained on his hands and knees, I knelt before him. "Can you stand?" I said, holding out my hand. He reached up and grasped it. "He needs help," I said. "Get him some water." No one moved. "Help him," I commanded. All eyes went to Aycliffe. He gave a small nod. Three of the men stepped forward and reached out to Bear. But when they touched him, he reared back like a wounded beast, and with a spurt of energy struck away their hands.
"Crispin," he called.
I went before him. He looked up, seemingly to make sure it was me, then lifted one of his long arms and set it on my shoulder. By sheer strength of will, he began to pull himself up, leaning much of his weight on me. When he finally stood, I could see how cruelly battered he was. Yet he was still large enough so that some of those looking on stepped back in awe. I was handed a jug of water, which I passed on to Bear. He clutched it in both hands and drank from it deeply, then let the rest cascade over his head and body. That done, he flung it away, letting the jug smash. The water helped him, though his breath was still laboured. He stood somewhat taller. He had managed to open his other eye, if only partly. "He needs some clothing," I said. Once again all eyes went to Aycliffe, who nodded. One of the men came forward, offering me a cloak. I placed it around Bear's shoulders.
"Put a hand on my shoulder," I said to him. "We're leaving."
Bear, standing behind me, did as I bid. But before me, in a semicircle, stood the steward and some 10 other men. All were armed. I took a step forward. No one moved. Heart hammering, I lifted my hand, the one that held the cross of lead.
"Shall I read what is written here?"
I said directly to Aycliffe. Bear's hand tightened slightly on my shoulder.
"Shall I?"
I repeated. For a moment there was no reply. Then the steward said,
"You must give it to me."
"You swore a vow to let us go first," I said.
He said,
"When you give it to me, you'll go free."
I shook my head.
"Once we're beyond the walls, you'll have it."
"I could kill you here," he said, "both of you."
"This man made a sacred vow to let us go," I said loudly. "He did so on this cross."
With all looking at him, Aycliffe seemed unsure what to do. Then I said,
"Shall I tell them who I am?"
The steward didn't reply. In the silence, I was sure all could have heard my heart hammering. Then Aycliffe said,
I'll take them to the city gates."
The men stepped to either side, allowing us a narrow passage. Aycliffe took the lead. I followed. Bear, his hand still resting on my shoulder, shuffled right behind me. I turned to look at him, but couldn't read his emotions. Moving slowly, we made our way through the cellar regions, then to the steps. Once there, I offered myself as a crutch to Bear, which he accepted, though I sensed that he was regaining something of his old strength. Even so, the climb was slow and painful. When we reached the first level, I could hear, if only dimly, church bells ringing. I wondered if they were tolling a call to arms or to prayer. More soldiers were on guard at the front door. When they didn't move, we all stopped. "Give me the cross," Aycliffe demanded.
"On your vow, not until we're safely past the city gates."
"Open the doors,"
he said angrily. The soldiers pushed open the doors. It was, as I had prayed, dawn. As we stepped out from the palace, the town's church bells were still ringing. Above the square, a whirl of agitated black birds circled through the air. Before us, traders were setting up their wares in stalls and tables. Those closest to us stopped their work and stared. Bear and I went forward. Aycliffe stayed with us, as did an escort of some 7 soldiers. "Wait!" I cried. I ran to the side of the palace and took up Bear's sack, then rejoined him.
"Take us to the gates,"
I said to Aycliffe. Though his look was full of hatred, the steward turned and began to move along the stone-paved road. We went slowly, a troop of soldiers all around us, while I wondered if they would truly let us go. Chapter 58. As we went along, passers-by stopped and gawked at us in silence. Others followed in our wake. "I have a dagger," I whispered to Bear as we approached the town gates.
"Give it to me," he said, and came close against my side. When he did, I slipped the dagger from my pocket and gave it to him.
He took it in his great hand, concealing it in the folds of his cloak. We reached the city gates. Though they were open, they were guarded by soldiers. Aycliffe paused and turned. In one hand he held his sword. In his other hand he had a dagger.
"Let us pass," I called out to Aycliffe.
In response, he shouted so all could hear,
"Both of you are traitors, and by my honour you'll go no farther. I may have made a vow to let you go, but this boy has been proclaimed a wolf's head. No one else is bound by my oath. Anyone may slay him. I'll give a pound reward to anyone who slays this wretched boy here and now."
I shrank close to Bear. It was he who cried out to Aycliffe,
"Coward! Traitor!"
"It's not you I want," the steward said. "It's the boy. He's vexed me long enough. Leave him, and you can have the reward."
In response, Bear shoved me behind him, so he faced the steward. His cloak had fallen away. In the morning's early light, his huge body was filthier, more bloody than I had realized. Whip and burn marks scored his chest and arms, but the dagger was in his hand.
"Son of Lucifer!" he cried to Aycliffe. "Oath-breaker! Murderer!"
I glanced around. The soldiers, swords in hand, had formed a semicircle behind us. Before us, it was much the same. Aycliffe stood unmoving, soldiers right behind him. Quickly, they shifted so that we, the steward, Bear and I, were completely surrounded. Some of the soldiers were grinning, so eager were they to watch us die. Beyond them, townspeople gathered too and gawked. Now the steward moved forward. His broadsword was extended and moved from side to side. The hand that held the dagger he kept wide. I tried to keep out of the way. Bear, with just the dagger held before him, remained unmoving, gazing at our enemy. Aycliffe made a thrust with his sword, which Bear stopped with a sudden movement of his dagger. The metal clashed loudly. From those around us, I heard a collective intake of breath. His stroke gone amiss, the steward backed away. Then the two men, breathing hard, eyed one another. Aycliffe made a series of lunges, first one way, then another, which Bear managed to beat off, but only because he retreated. Aycliffe paused again. It was Bear who now attacked, trying to slip sideways to the steward's dagger side while making a dive at the man's body. Now the steward swung wildly around with his broadsword, forcing Bear back. Once again the two men paused while trying to decide their next move. It was the steward who made the next series of thrusts. These Bear avoided, but I could see that he was tiring. Not only was he on the defensive, he was gradually being edged back toward the soldiers, who had lifted their swords up to make a wall of deadly spikes. Bear tried to move forward, but Aycliffe swung out wildly. "Bear," I shouted, "there are soldiers behind you." Whether he heard me or not, Bear tried to press back upon the steward. While he made some progress, it was very little. And now, as if some signal had passed between Aycliffe and the ring of soldiers, they began to creep forward, making the spiked circle smaller and smaller. It was then that Aycliffe swung hard while lunging. In doing so, he struck the dagger clear out of Bear's hand. The blade skittered across the stones. Bear made a move toward it, but was blocked by the steward and his blades. Then Aycliffe began to close in on Bear. But with all eyes on the two of them, I ran forward and snatched up the dagger. "Bear, I have the dagger!" I shouted. Hearing me, the steward swung about. Seeing me with the dagger, he raised his sword high, prepared to bring it down on me. At that moment, Bear leapt forward. With his great arms he hugged Aycliffe, pinning the steward's arms to his sides. The steward struggled to free himself, but Bear squeezed tighter and tighter, grunting like an animal, until the steward's sword and dagger fell to the ground with a double clang. Then Bear picked up the steward, held him over his head, and flung him bodily through the air at the soldiers. It happened so quickly, the soldiers had no time to react. Aycliffe was impaled on the soldiers' swords, run clear through by several points. I gasped with horror. From the onlookers, too, there was a great shout of terror. The soldiers, stunned and very frightened, moved back several steps as Aycliffe rolled back on the stone road, twitched, kicked, and became very still in his own pooling blood. No one moved. Then Bear, panting hard, snatched up the steward's dagger and sword and brandished them at the soldiers who stood before the city gate.
"Make way for us!" he bellowed, "or by St. Barnabas, you'll meet the selfsame fate."
The soldiers and the crowd slunk back. The way to the gates was clear.
"Crispin, hurry!" cried Bear.
I ran where the steward lay. From around my neck, I removed the cross of lead and laid it on the steward's bloody chest. With all eyes upon us, Bear and I walked out through the gate. No one said a word. Neither Bear nor I spoke. I could hardly believe what had happened.
"Crispin," said Bear as we moved away from the walls, "in that place they had me, I heard chants coming from the cathedral. The priests were singing Media Vita in Morte Sumus, which means, in the midst of life, there is death. But Crispin," he said,
Can't you see the new truth we've made? In the midst of death, there's life." I laughed and we embraced. Then, as we moved along the road, I swung Bear's sack around and pulled out his two-pointed hat, and leaping up, I plopped it on his head, albeit crookedly. But he removed the hat and then put it on my head. "I, Bear of York," he roared, loud enough for all the world to hear, "do dub this boy Crispin of Stromford, a full member of the Guild of Free Men. In so being, he is free of all obligations save to his God." I took out the recorder. When I began to play, Bear laughed. Then he began to sing. Though he didn't sing in his usual bellowing voice, it was his voice all the same. "Lady Fortune is friend and foe. Of poor she makes rich, and the rich poor also. Turns misery to prosperity, and wellness unto woe. So let no man trust this lady, who turns her wheel ever so." Then, as I played the pipe and Bear beat his drum, we two cantered forward on our journey. And by the ever-loving God who sits above, my heart was full of more joy than I had ever felt before. I was unfettered, alive to an earth I hardly knew, but was eager to explore. What's more, I knew that feeling to be my newfound soul, a soul that lived in freedom. And my name, I knew with all my heart, was Crispin.
The End. You've been listening to Crispin, the Cross of Lead by Arvi, narrated by Ron Keith. This work is copyrighted 2002 by Arvi. This recording is copyrighted 2002 by Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.